This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
All right. Let's go ahead and get started. I want to welcome you all to the beginning of a series that will last through September and to the first Sunday in October, when we will have our creation fair that's hosted by the Environmental Guild. But this series of lectures that Dr. Stephen Bishop is going to start us off with this Sunday is in conjunction with the season of creation and St. Francis Day. The season of creation, September the 1st through October the 4th, is celebrated by Christians around the world as a time for renewing, repairing, and restoring our relationship to God, one another, and all of creation. And so the Episcopal Church joins this international effort for prayer and action for climate justice and an end to environmental racism and ecological destruction. And so in celebrating the season, we're invited to consider anew our ecological, economic, and political ways of living. And so the speakers over the next 4 Sundays will be focused on this theme. And so I'm glad to have Dr. Stephen Bishop with us today. He is probably no stranger to many of you. Of course, he is married to Dr. Amy Minky, our Director of Newcomers here at St. David's. Steve grew up in Hearn, Texas, so native Texan, served as a minister for a dozen years before undertaking graduate studies at Boston University, where he earned a PhD. And since 2004, he's been teaching Old Testament at Seminary of the Southwest. He specializes in the study of the poetry of the Old Testament, particularly the Psalms, and he's going to be talking to us about the Psalms this morning. He co-authored a book, Out of the Depths, The Psalms Speak for Us Today, and continues to introduce parishioners across the country to the study of the Psalms. So, Stephen, welcome, and please come and share your wisdom with us.
Thank you. Mona, how do we get the PowerPoint up? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So welcome, everyone. It's good to be here. Good to be back with you again on this season of creation that Mona has shared with us the origins of it. And it's just exciting to be here and get to start this off looking at and thinking about creation as it comes to us from the Psalms. And there's a handout going around. It's Psalm 104 from the New Revised Standard Version, which we will looking at in a bit. That's going to be our text for today. But we're going to do a little background stuff, what we call in the seminary, a little world behind the text work. So we want to begin by asking you a question to think about this as, you know, I'd like to be as interactive as possible, when you think about creation and you think about creation stories, what is it that comes to your mind? What is the first thing that comes to your mind? Yeah. Right, Genesis 1, that's kind of at the forefront of our thinking about creation. Fortunately, there are actually in the Bible quite a number of creation accounts. I think of it like a musician who picks up a musical theme and does variations on that theme, and that's what we have in the Old Testament. Is we have creation being filtered to us through various themes. And so Psalm 104 is one of those themes. There are a couple of other psalms that do that, as well as a couple of places in other passages, particularly in the prophets, that lift up God's creative God's creative work. So what we want to begin by thinking about, I said, the world behind the text, that's the ancient Near East, the world out of which our biblical literature has come to us, is this world has influenced the way that stories are told and the way that things are imagined. So when we think about creation, sometimes we think about like what we have here on the slide, this photo from the Hubble Ultra Deep Telescope. It took, I forget, several years for them to actually make this exposure. And it is, there are about, I haven't counted them, but evidently NASA has, but there are about 10,000 galaxies represented on this, in this picture. Think about that for a minute. Not a solar system, but 10,000 galaxies. And what are the creation that we live in is so incredibly vast and expansive. And we can, sometimes we, you know, get lured into the kind of the science versus the myth of creation. You know, I'm really interested in astrophysics and you know, all the things that we've learned from science, quantum theory, not that I know anything about it, but I'm interested in it. And so but sometimes we think we have to accept one or the other. And one of the things I hope that we see today in Psalm 104 is that by looking at things through a poet's eyes, we're not stuck in that duality. And we're not stuck trying to bifurcate things, but through a poet's eyes, these myths that are taken over by Israelites that we see in the Psalms and other places kind of take on a different meaning for us in terms of thinking about creation and thinking about our place in creation. And thinking about God's relationship to the creation that God has made. So first we're going to explore a couple of ancient views. And let's see if I can do this. Should I hit the return button or?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Let's see. Usually it's like this one.
Yeah. How many PhDs does it take to figure out a PowerPoint?
PowerPoint.
Evidently more than two.
More than two.
So.
Oh, there we go. There it is right there.
Where is it?
Right there.
Oh, there it is. Okay, thank you. Ta-da. Yay. That's right. So the ancient Near East has a number of creation stories, creation myths. And in one of those that comes to us from an engraving, wall engraving in Sennacherib's palace, which is dated to 705 BCE to about 681, which is found in modern day Iraq. This has, you see, the human is variously described as either Marduk, and Marduk is a god, or Shemesh, which is also a god, or the king. And so it's hard to know exactly, but it's someone defeating this dragon. Notice this image. It's kind of like a dragon. It's got wings. It's got hands. It's got a fearsome face. It's got scales. It's got some kind of tail. I don't know if those are feathers. But in the ancient Near East, there were a number of stories that circulated that dealt with the creation of the cosmos, the creation of the world. And all of those myths feature a conflict. The conflict is between a deity and sort of lesser deities that are represented either by the sea or sometimes called the flood, the river, but it's water. It's a watery, chaotic conflict that this deity is involved in. And it's true in both in Mesopotamia, which is like around Iraq, Iran, that area now, and also Canaanite mythology, which is now like modern day Syria, Lebanon area. So we have stories coming from different cultures, but they all share the same thing, that there is a conflict out of which the deity, in this case, kills Tiamat and slices Tiamat in half, and the upper half becomes the sky and the lower half becomes the waters, the sea that's tamed, that has boundaries and borders in it. So that's one element that comes to us from the ancient Near East. And when we look at Psalm 104, it's important to keep in mind that we have these stories behind the psalm are these stories about chaos and struggle personified in some sea creature, some sea demon. Then moving on to another relief, that this one's sketched out a little differently, someone's line drawing, but it's also from the same period, from the same place in Nineveh. And notice what is in this image. So we'll start on the left. You have a serpent of some sort or a snake, and its body looks like water. So that gives us a sense of what that is. Then there is, in the middle, there is either a deity or a king. Again, not quite sure which one it could be. We say not quite sure because in much of the ancient Near Eastern world and in their cultures, the king was the embodiment of God. The king was the adopted son of God or was God. And we have it in Egyptian culture and in Mesopotamia culture. And notice he's so he's got something looks like a knife to kill this sea monster. So he must be really good at killing things. Notice his hand back behind his shoulder looks kind of like a claw, but it's supposed to be his hand. And the little fellow kneeling is handing him snowballs or rocks or something to help him to kill this dragon. And then as the scene progresses, we have someone who, interestingly, is not bearded. So maybe a woman that's being portrayed. The others have what are, in all these reliefs, all Assyrian men have these square beards. And but the person to the right also is holding a tambourine. And possibly, like as we read this relief, is this person is already celebrating the defeat of this sea monster. Celebrating the defeat of chaos. Another place for us to turn then, once we think about how in the ancient Near East they have this idea of this, particularly this watery chaos monster that goes by a lot of different names. And in this diagram, this is the picture of the earth that you do get very clearly from Genesis chapter 1. But that is a view of the cosmos that was shared by people of the ancient Near East. And again, this will help us in reading our psalm, particularly because the psalm has a lot to do with water and where water goes and where water doesn't go. And so you'll notice that the earth sets on a big block of earth. And inside that, we have Sheol, Hades, and Abaddon. These are all places of the dead. Hades being a Greek word. The other two are Hebrew words. And then underneath that, you will see we have the names Rahav, Tehom, Rabbah, Apsu, Tiamat, and then Leviathan, over on the far side. And Leviathan will appear in our psalm today as well. So these are all names for the same God of chaos. These are all the, these names. They come from different cultures, but they all represent the same idea, the same deity. And they're sort of, they're also primordial. It's from this this tehom, this deep, and also the word tehom, along with Leviathan, appears in Psalm 104 today. That this this primordial God, if you will, or monster that inhabits the sea must be defeated, must be overcome in order for order to come out of chaos. And then you see that the firmament, which is the dome over the top, which is actually the word used in Genesis 1, right? A dome. And that dome, notice that the stars and the moon are on the earth side of that dome. And that dome has a couple of little places where there are holes in it, which are called windows. And above that dome, there are waters above the firmament. So again, in Genesis chapter 1, we read God separated the waters above and the waters below. This is the image that they're building on. So this is the cosmology of the ancient Near East, and we'll see it particularly in Psalm 104. There will be some places where if you think about this and think about what's happening with the waters, it will hopefully become kind of clearer what the poet is imagining in that case. Another thing in our psalm that we should know about is so this is a Canaanite deity. And again, Canaan is modern day Syria, Lebanon. And this deity, Baal, who we read about in the Bible as an enemy of God, in, that was, I want to say 1929, that a library was discovered in Syria when someone was out plowing one day. He unearthed this library of clay tablets that are now called the Rashamra tablets. And those tablets, for the first time, we encountered stories about Baal outside of the Bible. And these whole cycles of Baal. Baal is a deity, a Canaanite deity, part of the Canaanite pantheon. And one of the things that we found in these tablets is that Baal is often called the rider of the clouds. And that is significant in our psalm, as we will see when we read it. Also, it's significant because in other places in the Old Testament, the God of Israel is described as riding on clouds. So the Israelites take this image from the Canaanite deities and apply it to their God. And in this picture, this is one of the few sculptures that are that were discovered that are have been identified as Baal. And his raised arm, either he had a lightning bolt in it or a spear in it. Baal is known for being the storm god. So thunder is Baal's voice. Lightning comes from Baal. Thunderstorms and rain come from Baal. And in this passage that I have here, it highlights the fact that Baal in this section has been missing for 8 years. And while he's gone, there is no dew, there's no rain. The waters don't come up from the deep as they typically do. And no goodly voice of Baal, which we understand to be thunder. So in this song, it's really a lament that Baal has disappeared. And as a result, they're in a drought. So so some of this imagery around Baal, a Canaanite deity, is also incorporated into our Psalm 104. which extols God as creator. Oops. Now, also in our Bible, we come across this this dragon, Leviathan, which we saw on the diagram of ancient Near Eastern cosmology. And in Leviticus chapter 27 and verse 1, we read, on that day, the Lord with his cruel and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent, and he will kill the dragon that is in the sea. So this this short verse, we sort of get all of this Canaanite mythology thrown into one and repurposed, in that it's Yahweh who slays this dragon, who slays this chaos dragon. And this is the same Leviathan that will appear in our psalm, but in a much different guise. I can't wait to get to that. But here's just a Doré's, if you like old Bibles, right? You know, Gustave Doré and his many woodcuts. They're fantastic to look at. So this this Leviathan is is this dragon, this chaos monster that the Bible remarks upon several different times, not just in Psalm 104 and Isaiah, but in other passages as well. So the final world behind the text that we're going to look at right now is this relief stone carving that comes from about 2450 BCE. Our Bibles, the stories that our Bibles first of all, the world behind the text stuff we saw from Nineveh, that rumor, that's like 700. This is 2400. So this idea of a seven-headed serpent, dragon, monster is very old. And in the Rosh Shamra text, those ones that I said came from Canaan, modern Lebanon and Syria, in those texts, the sea monster is called a seven-headed monster. So this idea of a monster with seven heads is an ancient idea. And in this text I have here on the screen, even as late as Revelation 12:3, which is written around 100 CE or AD, so almost somewhat 2,500 years after this image is made, mentions a great red dragon that has seven heads. So this idea of a seven-headed dragon in particular is quite old, and it continues to be used in our biblical literature. So let me ask you to look at Psalm 104, and I'm going to read the first nine verses, and what I want you to look for is the imagery that is used in these first nine verses, and I'll ask you to share what you notice, what kind of images, because we're in the poets deal in imagery. Poets deal not in abstract truths, but they create these very physical pictures for us. So Psalm 104, and this is from the New Revised Standard Version. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty, wrapped in light as with a garment. You stretch out the heavens like a tent. You set the beams of your chambers on the waters. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers, fire and flame your ministers. You set the earth on its foundation so that it shall never be shaken. You cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they flee. At the sound of your thunder, they take flight. They rose up to the mountains, ran down the valleys to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. Okay, so what kind of images stood out to you there?
Garments.
The what?
Garments.
Garments, yes, that's right. Yeah, it's thinking of these garments, these wrapping. He's very careful to, you know, use these verbs like putting on, wrapping himself with a garment. For it to be light, right? It's not a wool garment. It's light becomes a garment that God wraps God's self in. Yeah. Any, what other images stood out to you? Yes.
Boundaries that they may not pass.
Yeah. These boundaries, and particularly if we think about, you know, this, what is the nature of this watery chaos? It's not to have any boundaries. So Yahweh must be incredibly powerful to be able to take this chaos and control it. That's where in verse 8, verse 6, where it says, God, you, God, cover it, the earth, with tehom, which is the word we saw. This is the word here, tehom, the deep, is the poet, you know, wanting us to think about how here this chaos monster is not out of control, but is under God's control. You cover it. And just as God covers God's self in light like a garment, so God takes tehom and uses tehom like a garment. Not a real frightening image of a deity gone crazy, right? It's completely under the control of the God of Israel. Other things you notice? Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, and so this is why you have me here, right? To tell you these things. So this word that's used here for tent is only used about four times in the Old Testament. Usually it means a curtain of a tent. But I like that. But for me, that also is helpful because it connects with you saying this stretching out, like we thought of when we saw the dome that separates. It's like God set this tent and it separates these things. Yeah. Other things I saw some other people. Right. Yeah. Yeah. God becomes the rider of the clouds. And what is it? And kind of what that image, what does that image then play with it? What does it suggest to you? What does it mean to ride on the clouds? Yeah. Right. Exactly. God rides the clouds like, you know, I would ride a horse, which I have done. In spite of what you think. The rider is in control, the rider of the clouds. And that's where the storms come from. That's where the rain comes from, is from those clouds. And so Yahweh, Elohim, is the rider of those clouds, not Baal. Other things you notice just in these verses. Yes.
Waters above the mountains.
Right. The waters above the mountains. We have this image of the waters rising up above the mountains and then receding back into their place. This is an image of, we think of the chaos of the water monster, the sea monster, Tehom, Leviathan, overwhelming the earth. But again, it overwhelms it, but it does it under Yahweh's direction, under God's direction, and then recedes under God's direction. Yeah, other things, yeah.
He set the kings and the chambers on the water. And I'm saying that, you know, like the things that builds a house
Yeah, no. Well, I love that you noticed it, because it is and if you look at other translations, you'll see this word chambers can also be translated upper rooms. And I'll show you an image in a few moments that might help us to visualize this. But if some people suggesting that because it's the idea of upper rooms and God is above, so you know, we saw earlier in that cosmological picture that dome, and then above the dome was more waters, and then above the waters is God, and that God sets his foundation above those waters, on those waters. So it's outside, beyond the firmament in this cosmological world. Yes.
Doesn't it, that's really exciting. We see how Almighty God has a solo act.
Right. Exactly. Those are God's ministers. And I love it. Yeah, not a solo act, but it has other things. And those things, those messengers are also associated with storms, fire and flame, thunder and lightning. There's a lot of imagery in these first nine verses that take us back to Baal, the rider of the clouds, takes us back to other imagery, and that's part of the ancient Near East. Let's see, anyone else? Diane, I saw your hand, but
someone
okay, someone stole your thunder. Okay, so so those are some of the images. You've done a great job of pointing those out. Let's see if I could anticipate what you were going to say, shall we? So we've got all these, right? All of these images appear right in the first nine verses. The way that garment is used multiple times, and you know, the thing in reflecting and meditating on a psalm, you know, that might be something to meditate on is this idea of garments, God using Tehom as a garment, and God taking light and wrapping God's self in that light. I wanted to show you this image because it goes to what we were just talking about a moment ago. Here, this is from about 1180 BCE. So this is older than the things from Nineveh that we looked at, but not as old as the seven-headed serpent we looked at. So here's a cartoonish-looking serpent on the bottom of this, but representing, of course, the chaos. Representing the sea, the underworld, and notice the pillars that have been placed there. And the first tier are that those are humans. And those humans are in worship. This is a liturgy. This is a liturgical scene in this second tier. And above that tier are the deities that are a part of this world. So we have here this image of how God sets things on the waters, because these are below where the serpent is. There are waters represented there. And there's also, you can't really see it anymore, but at the very top of this cylinder, there is a supposed to be a serpent there as well. Not quite following the motif that the Israelites had, but still giving us a sense. In the ancient world, the cosmology, we were living in a contained environment. We didn't have a Hubble telescope view of things. Everything was contained in a bubble. Okay, so let's look then at verses. We'll just read the first 10 to... Verse verse 10 to verse 23. But again, the same sort of thing. Look for, listen for the images that are used. What images does this poet draw on? And how do those, what do those images evoke in us? But also try to think of this cosmology. And what would the early hearers, what would it evoke in them? We get to use our imagination, right? There's no right answer to those questions. So, but the psalmist says in verse 10 to God, you make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills, giving drink to every wild animal. The wild asses quench their thirst. By the streams, the birds of the air have their habitation. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. You cause the grass to grow for the cattle and plants for people to use, to bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the human heart. There you go. Oil to make the face shine and bread to strengthen the human heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. In them, the birds build their nests. The stork has its home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for the conies, or a rock badger. You have made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness, and it is night when all the animals of the forest come creeping out. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they withdraw and lie down in their dens. People go out to their work and to their labor until evening. Hey, so what did you notice here? What images stood out to you? Or what did they evoke in you?
Well, this is water, not as chaos, but water tame and doing its work to support us.
Yes, yes, exactly. This watery chaos that everyone in the ancient Near East is afraid of has been completely tamed. And because God has tamed it, God uses it for all of creation, for the benefit of all of creation. So yeah, it's a wonderful twist, right? On this, on taking this ancient idea and tweaking it into a new direction. Other thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So again, taking, you know, this world behind the text, creation is represented by chaos being tamed. But here in this psalm, this chaos is being ordered to the benefit of all living creatures, all of God's creatures. So that even I love it that the lions roar for their prey. Are they waiting for God to send it along? You know? So. They can eat. So even the lions are dependent upon God providing them with food. Any other things that stood out to you? Images? Yeah, yeah. Everything has a place. And back to that ordering, right? Even the so what's very curious, a lot of people will point out, what's very curious is the way that the cycle, the diurnal cycle is described here of day and night, because usually we talk about day and night, right? But here the poet reverses it and talks about the moon first and then talks about the sun. So that in this poem, the moon takes precedence. And perhaps one of the reasons that the moon takes precedence is because the moon is, the festivals and feasts are based on lunar calendars. And so it's the moon who's in this poem anyway, is the ruler. And it's these this lunar cycle within, I think, within this poem that is sort of highlighted in the order, how God orders things and cares for things. And that's reflected in human beings' participation in festivals and feasts that are connected to the moon and its cycle. So that, once again, it's another way of God including all of God's creation. And in going back to the very first line, bless the Lord, O my soul, it's the way of God including all of creation in that opportunity to give God thanks and praise. Any other things? Right, everything follows its order. Yeah. Right. Everyone has their place, right? Humans should stay home at night. That would shut down Sixth Street. Humans stay home at night. Let the animals, well, I guess we do that. Let the animals come out. Yeah, exactly. There's that. So there's this beautiful ordering coming out of a background where creation is associated with chaos. And here, notice that God has not, hasn't had a fight. You know, there hasn't been any fight going on. I'm going to see, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Okay, well, let's move on. We have until what time?
Till 11.
Okay. Perfect. So another image, just before we read the next passage, here is a section from an alabaster relief that's from about 721 to 705 BCE. These are Phoenician sailors. Israel was not big into sailing. So these are Phoenician sailors, and they're delivering lumber. That's what they're doing here. But if you, hopefully you can see in this picture, the sea is teeming with life. And it's teeming with fishes, and it's even got in front of one ship you see there, it has got some sort of deity, monster, something. And there's another one in front of it. So the sea is full of these things. And interestingly enough, what I've read about why all these ships have some sort of horse or some sort of animal head at the front is in case it confronts some sea monster, it will look like a sea monster. And so it was a very, even in this period of time, is a very real threat of, you know, the ocean not knowing what was in it. And knowing that there must be sea monsters right in there. So their fear. So this is from our psalm. This would be verse 25. Yonder is the sea, great and wide. Creeping things innumerable are there. Living things, both small and great. And there go the ships. And Leviathan that you form to sport in it. Leviathan has gone from being a sea monster of chaos to a pet. And not only that, but Psalm 104 says that God formed it. And the verb that's used there is the same verb that is used in Genesis 2, that God formed the human out of the dust of the earth, and God formed the animals out of the dust of the earth. In Psalm 104, Leviathan is not some terrifying monster. It's a pet that Yahweh made, formed, and it's to be sported with. Which crazy translation? I don't know, but I guess it would sound too mundane, right? To say to play with. But this relief that we see from the 8th century, gives us a sense of this. The sea is teeming with life, including Leviathan. The life of Leviathan is not to be feared. It's God's pet. So that is a really great image of taking something, this world behind the text of imagery, and repurposing it. Right, yeah. Yes, they have word. There's a word for serpent. There's a word for dragon, which is used in Isaiah 27. So there are some different words that are used. Leviathan, here, Leviathan isn't called a serpent or a dragon or anything, right? Like in Isaiah 27:1, where he is called a twisting serpent, dragon from the sea. Here, the psalmist, I guess, is just knowing that this name will arouse in us, evoke in us some connection with chaos and the sea monster and that sort of thing. So as we get to the conclusion of this psalm, let's see. So we just read through verse 26 and verse 27. Then these all look to you to give them their food in due season, or at the right time, or when it's appropriate. When you give to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. So here, I want to just look at a couple of these passages here toward the end for us to see how these images that we've been paying attention to, how they keep building on one another. These all look to you. Now, what are the these all? Who is the psalmist referring to that has just been referred to? Every creature, right? So every creature, even those that are in the sea, they all look to God. And God gives food to them in its time, at its right time, which is, again, just, I think, another reference to this notion of things happening seasonally, or things happen. Dependability. There's a dependability here, right? Is that things get their food in their season. And when you give, and what's interesting is that this goes back to the second half of the first verse we just read there. God gives, and then that is repeated. When you give, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good. And interesting, in Hebrew, it just says good. In our translation here, you'll notice it says good things, but it's actually just good. They'll be filled with good, which I like that. And then there's this little more troublesome verse. We've been told that God provides for all of creation in its proper time and at its time. And then we get the opposite side of that. So God provides for life, but when God hides God's face, they are terrified or thrown into a panic. It's kind of literally what it means. You collect or gather their breath, they perish and return to dust. And then this verse 30 is where there's what this translation here, sharing with you now is not the translation that's in the NRSV or anywhere else, because there's a lot of controversy over it. As it stands right now, as it's printed on your copy, it breaks the train. But this other translation, this alternate translation, I think keeps it, because we've been talking about God hiding God's face, God collecting their breath, and then God saying, you send off their breath or you send away their breath, they fall apart. And then you will renew the face of the earth. So again, for me, this particular translation of verse 30 then puts it all together, where you have, again, in verse 29a, you get God's face, and 30b, you get the face of the earth, which is poetic structure holding that together. And it really describing what happens, the reverse of what we see happening in Genesis 2 and 3. Where when God forms things out of the dust of the earth, God breathes into their breath, the breath of life. And at this point, then at some point, God then takes away that breath and they return to the earth from which they came, which to me fits with what we see in this whole poem, right? Is God is in control. God is sovereign over all life, over all creation, and everything happens as it's supposed to. It unfolds seasonally. It unfolds as it should. This is kind of a very idealistic view, I agree, of creation. But this is Psalm 104's vision of what creation is. So I want to close, and then we'll maybe have a moment for a few more comments. Just in terms of looking at this psalm as a whole, I hope that you can look at it and appreciate the structure of it, that it begins and ends with the exact same phrase. And in the middle, it tells us why we should bless the Lord. So it's a very instructive psalm. And then finally, this is the great conclusion of this psalm. Hallelujah. And this is, so the word hallelujah only appears in the Psalms in the Bible. Psalm 104 is the very first time it appears. It appears 19 more times after that. So 19 more Psalms after that. Some interpreters say, and I think it's great, is that by having this hallelujah at the end of a psalm, which is just celebrated God's sovereignty and God's care for all of creation, and God's reversing and taming what the chaotic forces of nature, is to respond in praise. And so this is the first hallelujah. And I always like to point out that hallelujah is actually a sentence. And in Hebrew, if I broke this down literally, it'd be, come on, y'all, praise, yeah. it's an imperative plural. And I was like thinking, come on, y'all, praise, yeah. That was the way it should really end. So this is a beautiful psalm, particularly a season of creation. We think about God's care for everything, to see how God is intimately connected in this psalm to humans and to animals, to the earth. It's all just a powerful testimony to God's care for creation. So are there any comments, questions? We have a couple of minutes, maybe. Yes.
There and one on paper for verse 30. Therefore, the spirit they are created. Your translation was, you send off their breath, they fall apart.
Right. Exactly.
And I'm wondering, is he getting things wrong? Or is it knowing that it maybe was in the original?
Yeah, it's not ambiguous at all. What I've done is I've made a very bold move here, The verb that is used there for create is a verb that in its those particular letters means a couple of other things. And one of the things it means is to separate. And so rather than seeing it as the dominant definition of create, if you read it as separate, then it to take apart, to fall apart, then it continues that thought of when God takes God's breath, when God removes God's breath from animals and humans, they fall apart and return to the earth. So
it, okay.
Yeah. Falling apart itself is also creation. It's creation of something different.
Right. It falls back into the face of the earth. Comes back
again.
Right. Yeah. Any other thoughts, comments, questions? Well, thank you very much. You've been great. It's been wonderful being here.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.